verse 14. That's Esther chapter 4, verse 14. For if the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish, yet, For if you remain completely silent from this time, relief and deliverance you will arise for the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. Yet who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as it?
You Bible students will remember that about 605, 606 years before Christ, the kingdom of Judah was taken captive by the Babylonians, and Jerusalem was not yet overrun, but there were a few captives at that time, and that one of those was named Daniel. Others were Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. About 597 BC, just a few years after that, there was the captivity of Jehoiachin, and during that captivity, there was one man taken captive that we'll read about in the book of Esther, and his name was Kish. Then about 586 BC, Jerusalem was finally destroyed, and the rest of the people were taken captive by the Babylonians. And that captivity was supposed to last 70 years. And of course it did, by God's calculations. It started about 605 BC in that way of thinking. And in 536 BC, Cyrus, the king of Persia, overran the Babylonians, and he declared that the Jews could come back home. But not all of them did. Some of them stayed in captivity, so that going up from 536 into the next century, 457 BC, some more came home. 445 BC, some more came home. But in that interval between 536 BC, when some of them went home, and 457, when some others started going home, there were still, of course, a lot of Jews that would remain out in the dispersion and would still remain there even after others came home. They just chose to, I suppose. But at this particular time, in Shushan, the citadel, in the country of Persia that was the ruling empire at that time, about 485 to 465 BC, there was a king by the name of Xerxes, the way secular history records him, and Ahasuerus, the way our translations of the Bible here record him. He is the king that was famous secularly for the battle at Thermopylae when the Persians came to march against Greece and 300 Spartans held them off. That's been immortalized in books and movies and as a historical account. This is that king, who is the king Ahasuerus in Esther chapter 1, who wanted to have a great big party for his servants, a great big party for his nobles and for his princes. He decided to have a great feast for everybody to be merry and for everybody to enjoy themselves, those who were important in his kingdom, and that feast would last about 180 days. Can you imagine a party that lasts half a year? These people were luxurious and they were lascivious. This is what they gave themselves to. Then after that party of 180 days, Esther chapter 1 tells us, he wanted to have another one for all the people, great and small, so he could include the common people. And for this one, at least, he spared no expense. There were, at this particular party, a lot of linens, blue and white linens, one verse tells us, with cords of white and gold, on silver rods, on pillars of marble, with gold and silver chairs and couches where they sat, and a mosaic of alabaster, turquoise, black, and white marble. The Bible is careful to point that out to us, perhaps, because it wants to show us the luxury that the king was spending upon the common people at this time. Maybe there was some sort of connection that he had to the common people that other kings had not. I don't know. It may be pertinent for us to notice that not everything back then was probably nearly as colorful as it is now today. We have color abounding on television, in virtual reality, on computers. We have color abounding in materials. But color, things that made color in the ancient world, were often things that were a little bit more expensive than the common man could afford. You know, it's kind of like when I was just a little bit younger and my kids were a little bit younger, the kids asked me, they said, Dad, when you were little, was everything still in black and white? Well, everything was in black and white except for the rich people to some degree here in Persia. So the king of Persia makes this great feast. And at this feast, it's important to note that the drinking was not compulsory as in accordance with the law. That's an interesting phrase that comes up there in verse 9 of chapter 1. In accordance with the law, the drinking was not compulsory. What that tells me is that it was possible in some empires at some times for the drinking to be compulsory. That is, that the government would force you into sin. There have been many times in history that the government has forced people into sin. In some of those cities that we studied that are mentioned in Asia, the book of Revelation, cities of Asia mentioned in the book of Revelation, some of them had trade guilds, and if you did not participate in the idolatrous, wildly violent and immoral parties of the trade guilds, you would not have a job. That's important to remember as our society devolves more and more into not only endorsing certain sins, but making everybody in the world accept them and making everybody do what those sinners want you to do. There may just come a point that people say, you have to participate in this as well, or you won't have a job. The drinking was not compulsory at this party, but apparently a lot of people drank. And this king got a little bit merry with wine, it seems, because then he commands that his queen come in and show her beauty to the people. She, apparently, although we're not given the reason she refuses, but she seems to me to take a noble stand, much unlike the daughter of Herodias, who would dance before the king or the daughter of Herodias who would dance before the king and cause John the Baptist to lose his head quite literally because of the lust of the king and the demands of her evil mother. Much unlike that, Queen Vashti says, I am not going to go in and show my beauty to these men. Well, that sends ripples and waves all throughout the kingdom because now all the guys are afraid if the queen can disobey the king, our wives are not going to obey us. So we got to do something about this. You see, this ancient Persia is the same area as modern Iran, and in that part of the world, women have never been treated equally, never been treated fairly. The best thing that ever happened to women in the history of the world was the religion of Christianity. Do you realize that? People say that Christianity oppresses women, but it's quite the opposite when Christianity is practiced as it was intended to be practiced. No, they're not going to be preachers, they're not going to be the public teachers, they're not going to be elders, they're not going to be deacons in the New Testament church, but that doesn't make anybody less important that you don't have a certain public role. Christianity, Christ, has raised the plight of women out of the drudges to where other religions put them. In Iran and other Muslim-run nations still today, women are second-class citizens, sometimes third- and fourth-class citizens. This Queen Vashti then disobeyed her husband, and the king became very afraid, and his nobles became very afraid, that all the other ladies would start disobeying their husbands, and they had to do something about it. So they decided that the queen would be dethroned. They decided that letters would be written out, sent into all the provinces, that all the wives should obey their husbands, and everybody should speak in their own language. Why that's thrown there at the end of chapter 1, I'm not sure. After these things took place in the third year of the reign of King Ahasuerus, which would have been about 482 BC, after his wrath subsided, he remembered Vashti and wondered what to do about losing the queen. Some people suggested we need a new queen. So the way of getting a new queen at that time was not for the king to go out and court somebody and not for him to date somebody and treat somebody well. No, this king was in power. Women were nothing. And so what the elders of the country, the nobles, decided to do was to send out people, a police force, if you will, a gathering force, and gather up young virgins from throughout the city, at least, and bring them to the king's palace and let them have some beauty preparations and let them go into the king one by one and then let the king choose from them who would be his queen. And so they did. It seems like it would be an honor to be a queen, but you're practically a slave at this point. I suppose you would have some recognition. I suppose you'd have some power. But these young virgins are just sort of captured, taken from their families, and they're put into the custody of Haggai, the king's eunuch. There was, then, at that time, a man named Mordecai, who was the son of Jair, who was the son of Shimei, who was the son of Kish, who'd been taken captive in the captivity of Jeconiah in 597 BC. Mordecai was a Jew. He had raised his uncle's daughter Esther, or Hadassah, because her parents had died. Esther was one of the young virgins that was rounded up at that time to be brought into the king's palace. It just so happened that that was the case. Mordecai had told Esther, don't tell anybody that you're a Jew, don't reveal your nationality, and Esther obeyed. Esther chapter 2 and verse 10. Esther had not revealed her people or her family, for Mordecai had charged her not to reveal it. Furthermore, Esther gained a good reputation in the household of those women among Haggai the eunuch, and he gave her more than her allowance for the things that she needed for beauty preparations. And then the beauty preparations got underway. Here's how long the beauty preparations were given for each woman. 6 months for oil of myrrh and 6 months for perfumes and other beauty preparations to get ready to go see the king. And you thought it took you a long time to get ready in the morning. A year they got ready for the king, and then when it was time for Esther to go into the queen, or to go into the king, she was humble. She didn't become a diva through all of this. She didn't demand any more that she needed. She just took what Haggai, the king's eunuch, recommended, chapter 2 and verse 15 tells us. She went into the king. This is now the seventh year of his reign, so it's 4 years after Vashti has been dethroned. It's about 478 BC or something like that. She goes into the king, and then when, like all the other virgins that went into the king, the next morning she goes into the house of Shashgaz, the king's eunuch who took care of the concubines, or the second-class wives, if you will. And the king delighted in Esther more than anybody else and chose her to be the next queen, but she still did not reveal her people. Now, at the end of chapter 2 is a little incident that you can just take and set over aside from the story up on a shelf for a little bit. It so happened that there were two other people by the name of Bigthan and Teresh who became really angry at the king, and they didn't just go on late night and talk about him. They decided to do something about it. They were going to kill him. This is the way things work in pagan empires, you see. And so in pagan empire, they were going to kill, sometimes unfortunately in empires that are less than pagan, but a lot of times in pagan empires, they were going to kill the king, but Mordecai was so worried about Esther that he kept close to the king's palace. And somehow he heard about their plot to kill the king. Mordecai got word to Esther the queen, so Esther the queen warned the king, Ahasuerus. Bigthan and Teresh were then hanged. And the king sat in his palace while the chroniclers, the secretaries, the scribes, wrote in the book of the kings of Persia that this had been done, that Bigthan and Teresh had a plot against the king, but Mordecai had uncovered it, and therefore the king's life was spared. Set that over on the shelf. Now, to continue with the narrative of Esther, here's some more things that happened with Mordecai. In chapter 3, Haman, the son of Hammedatha the Agagite, is promoted to a place that is very high in the kingdom, so that the king demands that everybody should bow down and worship him when he walks by. He likes that. He's a man who is filled with pride. He wants everybody to fall down and worship him, pay him homage. But there's one fellow who's not going to do that, this faithful Jew, Mordecai. Mordecai will not bow down to him. The king's servants wonder how long this could stand, that Mordecai would get away with not doing this. When Haman sees that Mordecai would not bow down to him, Haman is filled with wrath. But verse 6 tells us he disdained to lay hands on Mordecai alone, for they had told him of the people of Mordecai. They knew that the people of Mordecai were Jews, and therefore Haman didn't want to just kill Mordecai. He wanted to get all the Jews. There are a couple different ways to interpret that. One is that for some reason Haman was too cowardly to go after one man and challenge him to some kind of duel, and so he came up with this plot to get all of his people. Another way to look at it, which I think is more likely, is that Haman saw an opportunity here. The Jews were always a hated class of people because they've been God's chosen people, and he saw an opportunity to not only get Mordecai, but get every one of those Jews out of Persia and get them out of the world. Have an ancient Holocaust was his idea, and get rid of them. That's always been the case. There's always been people that wanted to do that, and Hitler's just the latest one. Ahasuerus wanted to do it then, simply because... Well, Ahasuerus would give the okay to do it simply because Haman wanted it done, simply because one Jew wouldn't bow down to him. People in our world get angry when Christians won't bow down to their immoral ideas and their pagan philosophies. And they trace that to Christians and they trace it to Judaism, and that's one reason people get angry at Jews sometimes. One reason people are anti-Semites is because they're also anti-Christian morality to some degree. That's what happened here. Haman is going to get Mordecai, and he's going to get all the Jews. And so they draw lots to determine which month this should happen. It is, at this particular occasion, the 13th day of the first month, and they draw lots, or Pur, P-U-R, to see when they should go out and kill all the Jews. And so a day is set that 11 months from then, on the 13th day of the 12th month, that everybody should go out and kill the Jews. An order goes out to the satraps, the governors, and all the people that on the 13th day of the 12th month, which is the month of Adar, everybody should go out and kill any Jews that they see. Everybody should go out and wipe out any Israelite people that they know. How would you feel if you got that letter in your hometown? Here's the letter that comes. Here's the town crier that comes out. I don't know what system they used. I know they use horses to get it out there, but I don't know what system they used to spread it around door to door. What if you get that letter at your door? What if you hear that letter read in the town and you had friends in town that were Jews? And then what if you're a Jew and you hear that letter? Oh, you've got 11 months to live. All your plans for the future are done. All your plans for your children are over. You are going to be mourning, and that's exactly what they did. Mordecai tore his clothes and sat in ashes and wailed. There was weeping and wailing and the cutting of hair and the casting of sackcloth, sitting in sackcloth all throughout the empire, simply because these people were going to be annihilated. They knew it, and they were desperate. Now, at that particular time, Esther heard about the weeping and the wailing, but hadn't apparently heard about why yet. So she sends some people out to Mordecai outside the king's gate. See, she's queen, but she still can't get outside the king's gate. She sends some people out to Mordecai and brings him some new clothes, but he won't take them. So she asks Hathach, one of the eunuchs, to go out and find out why it is Mordecai is so upset. And then Mordecai sends back a command to her that there's this going on. He tells her everything that's going on, sends her a copy of the written decree that all the Jews should be annihilated, and tells her that she's got to do something about it as the queen. She sends back to him a command for Mordecai in verse 10. When she says that all the king's servants, verse 11, and all the people of the king's provinces know that any man or woman who goes into the inner court of the king who has not been called, he has but one law, put all to death. You don't just walk into the king, even if you're the queen. You don't just go in and say, hey, I got something to talk to you about today, honey. That's not the way it worked. The king was the husband of many wives. He had many concubines. The queen was just one of them. And she had not been called into him for 30 days. And if she went into him without being invited into him, there was one law that she would be put to death unless the king happened to show mercy and extend forth his golden scepter that day because whoever came in found pleasure in his eyes. She didn't want to go in because of that. She really can't be blamed. But then Mordecai tries to impress upon her the seriousness of the situation. Mordecai says to her, do not think in your heart that you will escape in the king's palace any more than all the other Jews. Now, she hadn't revealed her people yet, but he tells her that it'll come out. And don't think that you're going to escape more than anybody else. Esther had always obeyed Mordecai. This is the one time she bucks a little bit, with good reason, it would seem. But he reminds her, you will perish as a Jew, even though you're in the king's palace. Then he says, for if you remain completely silent at this time, this phrase sends chills up my spine, relief and deliverance will come from another place. How does he know that? How does he know relief and deliverance will come from another place if Esther is silent? She's in a particular place to go to the king, but if she doesn't do it, how does he know the Jews are going to be saved? Because of God's promises, because of his faith. You see, from before the foundation of the world, God had promised to send the Christ. And from the time of Abraham, God had separated out a nation, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, or Israel, the 12 tribes, then the tribe of Judah, and then the lineage of David through which the Christ would come. God had separated out that people to bring the Christ into the world. One of the ways of looking at Israelite history is that their whole purpose was to bring Christ into the world to show people that Christ didn't just claim himself a religious leader. There was a whole nation that came about just to get us to him. Now, what if all that nation had been wiped out before we got to Christ? Or back up, there were other crises in biblical history. What if at the time of the flood, God didn't even spare Noah, his wife, Shem, Ham, Japheth, or their wives? Then the world would have ended, and all human beings who would have tried to live faithful before the flood would have never experienced the backward flowing blood of Christ to forgive their sins completely, because we would never have got to the blood of Christ. And so God saved 8 people. Now, the Jews are in danger of being extinguished again. and we're not going to get to the Christ. We're 400 years too early, the way we know now. So Mordecai knows God's going to save us one way or the other. If you speak up, good for you. But if you don't, God's going to save us. If you remain completely silent at this time, deliverance will arise from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. You'll be done, but the Jews will be saved. And then he says this, "For who knows whether you have come to the kingdom for such a time as this?" I mean, here you were, fourth generation, fifth generation in captivity. And here's the foreknowledge of God, knowing that this horrible event might come up. And here it just so happens that you're rounded up with the virgins in Shushan the citadel. And it just so happens that the king chooses you, a young Jewish girl that he doesn't know is a Jewish girl. It so happens that you've risen to the place of queen and you have authority or influence with the king like nobody else does. Even as little as you have, it's like nobody else does. Who knows whether you've come to the kingdom for such a time as this? So Esther then told them to reply to Mordecai, "Go, gather all the Jews who are present in Shushan and fast for me. Neither eat nor drink for 3 days, night or day. My maids and I will fast likewise. And so I will go to the king, which is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. I'm going to die anyway. I'll go do this act of courage on behalf of my people." Wow. What a lady. So Mordecai went his way and did according to all that Esther commanded him. Chapter 5 opens that on the third day, Esther put on her royal robes and stood in the inner court of the king's palace, and the king just kind of spotted her. I'm not sure exactly how this palace was built and how things worked, but she wasn't quite in the presence of the king yet, but she was in her royal robes and ready, and the king spotted her, and he stretched out the royal staff to her, and she came and bowed and touched the top of it. And then the king said to her, "What do you wish, Queen Esther? What is your request? It shall be given to you, up to half the kingdom." That's a pretty big order there, that he's willing to give her 49% of the kingdom. Maybe he'd still have 51% and still be in control. Maybe he's speaking in hyperbole, some have said. I don't know. But whatever it is, Esther really impressed this king. "What do you want? It'll be given to you up to half the kingdom." She says, "I just want you and Haman to come to a banquet that I've prepared today." King says, "Good." Sends people to get Haman. They go to a banquet. When his heart's merry with wine again, we figure, he says, "What do you want, Esther? It'll be given to you up to half the kingdom." And she says, "What I want from the king is for you and Haman to come to another banquet tomorrow." Now, some people would say maybe she chickened out there halfway into the request and just thought of another banquet tomorrow. I don't know her heart. We're not given that information. I kind of doubt it, because it seems to play into God's plan a little bit right here, because this night that comes up is an eventful night. The night between the first banquet and the second banquet really becomes quite eventful. So the king says, "Okay, we'll come to that banquet tomorrow." Now Haman is walking home, and he's walking on cloud nine. He's feeling all full of himself. He's got a glad heart. He then saw Mordecai sitting in the king's gate, and all his gladness was gone, and he was filled with indignation. He went home and pouted to his wife Zeresh and his friends, and he said, "Look, the king has raised me up here, and I've got all this glory, and I've got all this power, I've got all this influence with the king, but as long as Mordecai, the Jew, does not bow down to me, it avails me nothing. This one thing I can't have, and everything else is lost." This is the pride and the character of this infantile man. So his wife Zeresh said, "Well, why don't you have a gallows be built tonight, 50 cubits high," that's about 75 feet or 80 feet high probably, pretty tall gallows. "Why don't you have that built tonight? And in the morning, you go to the king and suggest that Mordecai be hanged on it. King listens to you. He'll probably get your way." That night, it just so happened that the king could not sleep. And that night, being in ancient Persia, he didn't turn on the TV and watch reruns of anything, didn't watch any late night shows. He had somebody read to him the book of the Chronicles of the Kings of Persia, because you're the king of Persia. Why would you read something else? Have somebody read to you your own history. And so, it just so happened that the person was reading from the account where Mordecai had saved the king's life. Remember that item on the shelf over here, when Bigthan and Teresh wanted to kill him? When the king heard this being read to him that night, as it apparently approaches early in the morning, He says, has anything been done to honor Mordecai for saving my life? And he is given the answer, no, nothing has been done to honor Mordecai. About that time, as morning starts to break apparently, he sees Haman out in the foyer and he says, who's out there? And it's Haman, the son of Hammedatha. He brings him in and he says, Haman, I got a question for you. What should be done for the man whom the king delights to honor? Well, Haman thinks it's him. So Haman says, here's what you ought to do for the man whom the king delights to honor. Get a royal robe which the king has worn. Get a royal horse on which the king has ridden and a royal crest. And get one of the highest nobles in the land to take this man, whoever it is, and put the robe on him, put him on the horse, and parade him around the town of Shushan, the citadel, saying, thus it shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor. Thus it shall be done for the man whom the king delights to honor. And the king says, good idea. Why don't you go do that for Mordecai? Can you hear the begrudgingness in his voice as he would have done that? Oh, he did it. But he went home with his head covered. And he went home and pouted to his wife again. And his wife had a little bit of sense this time. She said, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of Jewish descent, you will not prevail against him, but will surely fall before him. Chapter 6, verse 13. Comes time then to go to the banquet the next day. And Haman and the king are eating and Esther's serving the banquet. The king asks again, Esther, what shall be given to you up to half the kingdom? And she says to him, if I have found favor in your sight, verse 3 of chapter 7, O king, and if it pleases the king, let my life be given to me at my petition and my people at my request. For we have been sold, my people and I, to be destroyed, to be killed, to be annihilated. If we had been sold as male and female slaves, I would have held my tongue, although the enemy could never compensate for the king's loss. King Ahasuerus is upset. He answers her and says, who is he and where is he who would dare presume in his heart to do such a thing, to kill all the Jews? She says, the adversary and enemy is this wicked Haman. The king then is so furious that he gets up and steps outside into his palace garden, maybe to collect himself, I don't know. But while he's outside in the palace garden, Haman is before the queen begging for his life. Right at the moment the king comes back into the room, Haman trips and falls on top of the queen. That looks good to the king. And he says, will he also assault the queen while he's in my house? And at that time, some little eunuch that didn't like Haman all that much apparently stepped forward and said, you know, king, there's a gallows outside that Haman built for Mordecai. And the king says, good, hang Haman on the gallows that were built for Mordecai. And Haman was hanged. And then the king gave all of Haman's household and everything that he owned into Esther's hand. And Esther gave it to Mordecai to take care of. And Mordecai eventually would rise to second in the land. But there's still this matter of the rule of law that we get from the Persians. That law that everybody was to kill Jews on the 13th day of the 12th month was still in effect. So what are we going to do about that? Esther approaches the king and says, we've got to do something about that. The king says, take my signet ring and write what law you want. So they write a law that on the 13th day of the 12th month, the Jews are to go out and defend themselves and fight against those who would persecute them and fight against those who would attack them and be able to kill and annihilate those people who would kill and annihilate them. Now, I used to think, what a futile command that would be. I finally asked one of my friends, why is this significant? Weren't they going to defend themselves anyway? Wouldn't people just defend themselves when they're being attacked? And my friend enlightened me. I'm a slow learner sometimes. He enlightened me and he said this, what that does is takes the police force out of it. Takes the governors and the satraps who got the letter. No, they're going to stand back now, at least, and maybe be on the side of the Jews. A lot of people converted to Judaism because they were afraid of the Jews. A lot of people became Jews simply because they didn't want to be killed by the Jews. Apparently there were enough to cause some fear, but the police force stays out now, and on the 13th day when those attackers come out to carry out that one law of the king, the Jews carry out that other law of the king and are allowed to kill those people who are their attackers. They kill 75,000 in the empire, 500 in Shushan. Esther asks for one more day of killing in Shushan, and they get 300 more, and finally the thing is done. There are a few lessons to learn that we haven't tapped on already. Real briefly, they're obvious, but let's list them. First, the providence of God. Do you realize that the book of Esther had trouble making it into the Old Testament? Now, when I say that, please let me clarify. God always knew it was going to be in the Old Testament. That process was through people recognizing that this was an inspired work of God. But there were some people for a while that didn't want the book of Esther to be recognized as an inspired work because it didn't have the name of God in it. But you can see God working all through it, can't you? And it doesn't have any miracles. I've told you before, but it bears repeating, that there was a fellow one time who told me that I was limiting the power of God by not believing in modern day miracles. What I should have said to him was, no, you're limiting the power of God by saying that God has to use miracles to work. God can work through his providence just as powerfully as he can with a miracle. It might not be as showy, it might not be bringing people back from the dead, but God still has power, and that's why we pray today in this non-miraculous age, the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much, James chapter 5, verse 16. You think all this is just coincidence, that this young virgin girl that just happened to be there from the Jewish kingdom would just happen to be taken into the king's palace and just happen to gain the king's favor and just happen to be there at the right time, while Mordecai is just happening to be outside when he hears a big Thanateros' plot and she's able to get that. And then also happens that when the Jews are about to be killed, that the king just happens to hear from that particular place because it happened that he wasn't able to sleep that night, and all this just happened this way? No. Providence of God does amazing things, and we might not see miraculous healings. We won't see miraculous healings. We won't see people walking on water. We won't see people being raised from the dead. But we can pray nonetheless, and we can know that God hears our prayers, and we can know that those prayers ascend to his throne, and we can know that if it is his will, those things will be done. We can know that he'll do what's good for us. It may not be what we want. It may be what we want, but we know that his providence is active. We don't know where all the time. Even the Apostle Paul said, perhaps this happened for a particular reason in Philemon verse 15. Just like in the book of Esther, perhaps this happened this way and this way and this way. When it seems to add up like that, you can pretty much tell it's the providence of God. You still have to be humble about it. Secondly, we ought to note that pride goes before destruction and a haughty spirit before the fall. Proverbs 16 verse 18. Better to be of a humble spirit with the lowly than to divide the spoil with the proud. Proverbs 16 verse 19. Look at Haman. Such a proud man, and what happened to him? Psalm 10, verse 2, the wicked in his pride persecutes the poor. Then there's a prayer for the wicked. Let them be caught in the plots which they have devised. Haman was caught in the plots which he had devised. There's a visual aid for the instruction of Psalm 10, verse 2. When pride comes, then comes shame, but with the humble is wisdom. Proverbs 11 and verse 2. Proverbs 13, verse 10, by pride comes nothing but strife, but with the well-advised is wisdom. Proverbs 14, verse 3. In a fool's mouth is a rod of pride, but the lips of the wise will preserve them. Proverbs 29, verse 23. By a man's pride will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor. And that's the third lesson. Look at the selflessness of Esther. You talk about her courage. If I perish, I perish. But what does it take to have courage? What is behind courage? Courage has to be inspired by selflessness. If you're all about yourself, you're never going to have courage to stand up for somebody else or for a cause bigger than you. If you are a person who does not love your life to the death, however, like those in Revelation chapter 12, verse 11, then you will be persuaded to stand up for a good cause, particularly the cause of God, particularly in this era, the cause of Christ. Courage requires selflessness, and here is selfless Esther. She never thought of herself too highly. Yes, she was given 6 months of oil and myrrh and 6 months of perfumes, but she never took more than was recommended. Yes, she was going to be queen, but she was still obeying her cousin that's raising her. She is obedient and selfless. For I say, through the grace given to me, to everyone who is among you, not to think of himself more highly than he ought to think, but to think soberly, as God has dealt to each one a measure of faith. Romans chapter 12, verse 3. And therein, it would seem to me, as a foreshadowing of the kind of courage and selflessness that it takes to be a Christian. None of us, hopefully, will be put in the kind of extreme circumstance that Esther was. But we follow a Lord who selflessly went to an extreme measure, the extreme measure of the cross to save our sins. And we follow a Lord who said, if you're going to follow me, deny yourself and take up your cross and follow me. Whoever desires to save his life will lose it, and whoever loses his life for my sake in the Gospels, the same shall save it. Luke 9, 23 and 24 for one place. We follow a Savior who demands selflessness of us. And when two disciples came to him and said, "Let us be great, one on your right hand and one on your left," he said, "That's not the way it works here. You're supposed to be the servants of all." Sometimes we're tempted to forget that in a get-ahead sort of world, that we're supposed to be the servants of all. Let's remember selfless, courageous, heroic Esther and the way God worked his providence through her circumstance. We may not be in anything that extreme, but maybe God can touch a life through our circumstances by his providence, without anything miraculous, but by our obeying the word of God and teaching other people the same word. Are you a Christian tonight? It takes selflessness. Believe in Jesus Christ as the Son of God. Commit your life to him by repenting of your sins, confessing him, being baptized for the remission of sins. Live faithfully to him. If you've not been faithful to him, have some humility and repent and confess your wrongs and pray for forgiveness. If we could help you, please come as we stand and sing.